see if this is loud enough.
Yeah, and I wonder why, I've forgotten what I was, probably you remember where I was left off, but I don't.
Okay, I'm with Mr.
Floyd Fuller.
Perfect. Well, we were...
Well, I think we went through pretty much of the industry of Warren.
Yeah, we talked about the different
metals. And then, of course, in the past, I guess I told you how my dad learned to be a veterinarian.
Yeah.
And his horse training, his breeding. And I guess I must have mentioned that he done artificial insemination.
Now, how did he get started on that?
That I can't answer you, but the reason he did it back, of course, this was many years back, is when I first began to tell people about it, they almost thought I was lying to them. They said it was impossible because they didn't do it, they didn't freeze it and all that kind of stuff for semen. But he did it because he used to stand his, what he called stand his stallion in different towns certain days. And if they brought too many mares, that would be bred. The horse can only breed so many mares in a day. And if there were too many mares for the horse, he'd be out of luck. So I don't know how he got started, but he bought the equipment and he used to be, see there were too many, he'd take and breed a mare with the artificial sack, and then he'd take it from that sack and breed some other mares artificially.
That was very early.
Oh yeah, way back, I can remember way back, you were doing that in 1908, 1909, long in there.
So he must have been one of the first people.
He was, I don't know what you might say, he was somebody ahead of his age, I guess. Now why he got the idea or anything about it, and all of his wonderful things he did, we boys, I don't think any of us, Earl or any of us ever knew what got him started to do those things, but it was in him. Now, you know, and as I say, when I first began to tell it back here a few years ago, and they was having a show down here of the artificial insemination on the tape, videotape. This lady that was going to have a place down to her place, and people come in and see it. When I told her about my dad, she almost thought I was lying about it, called me a liar almost, but she said, "Why? That's impossible." I said, he sent over to England and got some semen way back in 1910 or so. Why, she says, that's impossible, because she says, they weren't doing artificial insemination then. Well, I says, in England they did. They done it way long in England, and through some of his books or reading or something, maybe that's where he started from. I don't know. But he sent over because he wanted to get a breeding of a Hamiltonian. And so he sent over and got the semen and bred a mare. I was young, I don't remember. I remember the time, but I don't remember what the mare was. I think probably it was a Morgan mare. And he bred her and he got a stud colt, which I don't know whether I showed you the picture of him or not.
Which colt was that?
The black stallion that he had, Frank M. Did I show you those pictures?
I don't know.
From out in the car?
I don't think so.
And a little folded, one of his folds?
Oh, maybe you did.
And that was way back then that he sent and got that semen and...
That's amazing.
And
amazing.
So that's why he did the artificial insemination, is when there were too many for the stallion to breed in a day.
Well, I've been very impressed in talking with people how forward-looking some of the people of Warren really were.
Yep. And, you know, as I say, that man, I don't know... He was one of a few who could think ahead and know what he wanted, and if he didn't have it, he got it. He made it or something. If he made up his mind he was going to have it, he'd have it. And that's the way he done things, and that's why he accomplished what he did and had his blacksmith shop and all that kind of stuff, so he could do everything, corrective shoeing and his veterinary work and castrations and everything else. Was just simply wonderful, and a fellow that never went to college on it either.
Do you remember his father?
No, my grandparents were all, both sides were all gone before I was born.
And so, you said you had this uncle that named you.
Yeah.
Did you have, was he a very special uncle to you?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. He was my mother's brother, and he was another awful lover of horses and a good trainer. and a wonderful, wonderful caretaker. I'm telling you, his horse has got the best of care. And so he's the one that named me and gave my folks a sheep, and they were to keep it and have the proceeds put in the bank for me. So that was him. But he lived up in Berlin, had a farm up in Berlin, Vermont. And so I used to go up there quite a lot and just stay up there once in a while. I loved it because, well, he thought I was pretty special, and I used to like to go with him when he took his cream down to Williamstown Creamery and ride with him, and we put his horses in a shed down there and hitch them. We always had to go in the drugstore somewhere to have ice cream or something to eat, you know, and for a little kid like that. And every night before he went to bed, he used to go in the pantry, and we had a little stool, and we set up there and eat. Well, I don't know what you can buy now, the cereal they call Force. And he got to have a little dish of Force before he went to bed. And so I used to enjoy that. And but he was a wonderful, wonderful farmer and caretaker. And in fact, he had a milk room that he separated milk in, and he paired it, run the separator with a buck sheep and a tread power.
Is that right?
And that old sheep loved it. You know, when he'd on hitch him, get ready to separate on hitch him, he'd go out through the alleyway, out around, and right up into that power without anybody leading him. And he used them for power to separate the milk and get the cream to go to the creamery.
I'll be darned. Did he have a lot of sheep?
Quite a few, yes. He raised a lot of sheep.
A particular kind, or?
I don't remember what they were. They was, all I know was a kid that there was sheep. Like my daughter, I guess it was a Shropshire sheep, white ones. And so he had a lot of them. And he, like my dad, cut out having sheep after a while because the dogs got to bother them so much, and the bears occasionally was bothering them. So he got sick of having sheep, and so he stopped having them. And my uncle, they cut it out quite a while afterwards. And I probably told you about my dad getting a bear in a trap and bringing it up.
Yeah. Now, did your father do things like fox hunting?
No, no. Only thing he ever did was go deer hunting. He loved to go out deer hunting. And that's all he ever hunted. And, well, he never had time to, another time to do anything, I guess, with so much. Because when you figure he started out with one small farm and ended up with 450 acres.
That's amazing, yeah.
And all those horses and cattle and that like. And he never hired in too much of boys. The boys did the work until the very last. And of course, they grew up and left and that like. But Lauren, my good brother, he stayed with Dad all his time. And then bought the farm afterwards. When Dad got ready to retire, he bought the farm in 1930. And Dad then came down to Rochester, where I was living, and bought a place in Rochester. And my brother operated the farm, I don't know, quite a few years, and then he sold out. And
how do you spell Lauren?
L-O-R-E-N.
Uh-huh. And he sold out to the Bowen Hunter Bobbin Mill.
Yep.
And then moved down to
the Sugar Bush there. Bought that little place down there and had a few cows. And
what made him decide to sell out?
Well, the help situation, and there was a lot of bother to get help, and it was a big farm to carry on, and so he, and also he was being called away a lot to do horse shoeing, because he was a good horse shoer. And so, I don't know, for one reason, as far as I know, he just simply decided he'd not have so big a load on his back to take care of, and so he sold out.
But he must have done well selling to the Bobbin Mill, and particularly 450 acres.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they wanted it for the timber?
Yeah, they, well, this, what is his name? Oh, I can't think, but anyway, came over from Corinth, the fellow did it, bought him, Boyd and Hunter. And this Mr. Boyd, I guess it was, bought it for the lumber. There was a lot of lumber on it. And of course, he went in and lumbered it off. And in the meantime, he was planning on setting his son-in-law up in business, which he bought cattle and had his son-in-law operate the farm. And after he got the lumber cut off, that like, and I don't know, he wanted his son-in-law wanted there only, oh, I don't know, maybe a year and a half or 2 years. And in the meantime, during that time, he went to Florida. And when he came back in the spring, his son-in-law got sick of it and had an auction, sold off all the cattle and stuff. And he told my brother, he says, this was the third time. He said, I've set him up in business. He said, it's the last time, too. So then he said, and then from that, he sold the farm to a Chinese fella.
A Chinese fella?
Yeah. Oh, what is his name?
Guy Cheng or somebody like that?
Yeah, yeah. I did know his name.
Where did he come from?
I don't know, but he bought it.
That's odd at that period of time.
Yeah.
And had he been living in Warren Long?
I don't know where he come from, because I wasn't living around there at the time. And
yeah.
And who his name was. Wu.
Wu.
Yeah.
Huh.
And after he up there a while and got things pretty well run down and that like, he sold out, I guess. I don't know what did happen, but he moved and he lived for a while down in Irisville, a little settlement this side of Waitsfield. And you know, I remember his name, Mr. Wu, W-O-O, I guess it was. But he was there a while, but he didn't, things all went to pieces. He didn't take care of things, and some of the cattle was kind of on the thin side and didn't take good care of them and that like. And so that's what happened to the end up. So now there's nothing but the stone wall and the old house there. But.
Well, you, after leaving there when you were 21, to go back now, you just must be shocked.
Oh, it is. I go out there real often because so many people that know me have got acquainted with me, and I like her, and they've also amazed that I showed them a picture I carried in the car of that stone wall that Dad laid in 1913. Everybody's so amazed that wall has stood so many years. No building on it, anything else, and it's still straight and sound. And so I've had a lot of people, I've taken over there to see it, and I love to go over there and show them the work Dad did and all about the place where I was brought up and show them the old sugar house where I bought a sap when I was only 12. But when I go up there, it makes me feel bad to look at that house as I was when I lived. I left home, and then now it's a hard-looking thing as far as I'm concerned. But the stone wall, I'm very proud of, and that like I've got, two people here since she was here. A lady up in Plainfield come in and called on me the other day, and she was down this way and come in and called on me. And she was a past secretary for the council. She said, Floyd, this summer, I'm coming down to you and make a date, and we're going over to Warren, and we're going to spend the day looking around and have dinner and have you show me all around that place. And then there's some other people that are same way, want to go and see the place. And so I've got several trips I got to make. And also the other night.
Sign me on, too. I'd love to.
Melody Blitterdoff, I'm up in Jericho. She, I've known her for a long time, to her heart. She got a nice little place up on Borchardt. And her husband and her friend was coming down here to Randolph to some evening auction of secondhand stuff. And that like, said she didn't want to go to auction, so she called me about 4 o'clock. Said, Floyd, are you home? I said, yeah, of course I am. I wouldn't talk to you if I wasn't. And she laughed. She said, well, you want some company this evening? And I said, oh, gee, can't I think of something to say that I'm going to be busy? Because I said, I love the woman. She's so nice. She got one little girl that thinks I'm wonderful, and her other daughter, just 16. And, well, they call me Grandpa. And so, anyway, I was glad to have her. So she came down and spent the evening. We went out and had dinner together, supper that night, and stayed until they got through the auction. And then they come up here. And so before they left, she said to Jeff, her husband, she says, this summer, she says, we're coming down and have Floyd take us over to Warren and show us his old home place and what his father did. And she said, it's going to be happening. We were going to do it last year, but this year, she said, it's going to happen.
Did you know Tom and Biddy Egan?
No.
They may have been more your mother's generation, but...
remember, no, I don't know who he was, but I remember Dad's brought back memories. One night he was coming from out in Granville. He'd been out there sort of after dark and that like, and he come across this man that had, it was in an old buckboard wagon, and he'd passed out, and the horse stood side the road, and this man was dead in his wagon, tipped over and... Now, I don't remember what his name was or anything about it, but Dad found him and...
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah.
Gosh.
No, but I don't so long. I was a young kid, remember. Dad come in telling about it, found a dead man in a wagon. And I don't have no idea who it was. But things like that did happen once in a while, I guess.
Yeah.
And... But my uncle Will Curtis had named me. I wish I could have been where I could have. He had a beautiful horse. I haven't told you that, but he had a beautiful horse, Tony. And he'd worked with him and had him so well trained. And every time we went over a bit, and he had him, well, he used to race him on the ice in Montpelier on the river. They used to have horse races on the river there in Montpelier. On the ice, in their sulkies. Sure. And so he was a pretty fast-going horse. He never had taken him to any big races and didn't cat. But he was a beautiful horse. And so Uncle Will told me one time, he says, if anything happened to me, and he says, I've got it, so my son Clayton had always lived there at home and took care of Dad and Mother and that like. They knew where it was in paper or not, but anything happened to him, that horse was to be mine. And of course, he passed away while I was in Massachusetts. The result was, of course, I had no place for the horse, and so I didn't have a chance to have him, but boy, he was a beautiful, beautiful animal. And, you know, this is unbelievable, but this is the truth. That horse thought so much when Uncle Will was last of his living and sick, the house and barn joined together with a, well, a big alleyway here, closed in walk from the barn right into the back room to the house and from there right into the house, see? And so Clayton led Tony into the bedroom to see his Uncle Will.
Oh.
And that horse, he said, nuzzled him, lapped his face, and done him a lot of good.
I bet.
And, but you know, this is unbelievable, but it's true. I know Clayton, my cousin, was honest. And I, you know, shortly after that, that horse went blind. That's God's honest truth.
It's amazing.
Yeah. But that horse, well, of course, he was petted and he was brushed off and cleaned twice a day. That horse every morning got a grooming and cleaning, and every night before Uncle Will, when he's able to get around, went to bed, that horse got a nice cleaning. And I'm telling you, he had a bed to lay in almost like a burn. He had straw, well, 8-10 inches of old straw, sawdust under the old straw. And boy, I'm telling you, he had some wonderful care. That's the kind of fellow he was, but I always
felt. Did the horse live long after
he No, we didn't. No, no. Not to, I don't know just how long, but Clayton told me I was in Massachusetts at the time, and so and then when I came up here, I went up to see Clayton, and my Aunt Julia, where my aunt was alive, he died first, and they told me what happened to Tony, and that he went blind. No time afterward. And they said that, he seemed to know our trunk wheel was gone because he was uneasy in the stall. He didn't eat good and he'd take his foot and paw and And every time he heard somebody coming out through the alleyway, you know, they said he'd stand there and prick up his ear and listen and expect to see him, but he didn't. Mm. So.
Well, he must have missed him.
Oh, but you tell that some people, they think you're telling a bib fib. But I tell you, horses.
No, you care about an animal, the animal knows it.
Well, I know it. And they appreciate good care. My old beauty that I had for 25 years, go out and holler to her in the pasture, she'd come, they'd come up and say, "Beauty, you love me?" And she'd lap my face. So.
Was that your favorite horse, Beauty?
Yeah, my best one I ever had. I bought her when she was 3 years old and I had her 25 years. She was just Hollerbrook and I had to train to do tricks with a whip, like I guess I told you about, and do those kind of things. And had her in the 4th of July parade, it had been her. And
how did she die?
I put her down because she had soft teeth and her molars got worn down so that she didn't have any. And for about 2 years, I kept her on gruel and stuff she could drink because she couldn't eat any roughage. And I kept her for about 2 years, and then it got so old I couldn't keep her looking. And her ribs and bone began to show, and I couldn't stand that, so I hired a fellow to bury her for me. But
I suppose one of the biggest changes in Warren that you saw was going from really horses to the automobile.
Yeah. Yeah. And I told you about seeing the first car that came into Warren, that old Stanley Steamer. Yeah, but it was automobiles when they first came out. My dad and a lot of people said, well, they were against having automobiles that old timers were, because they said, well, those things in the road are going to scare the horses to death, and boy, they're crazy. But before we got through, everybody owned one, you know.
Did your father ever buy one?
Yeah, in 1917, he bought a Model T Ford. Bought it over here in Randolph. $365. Had to pay extra. Why the $365? He had to pay, I forget how much extra, to have a speedometer. But the old Model Ts, when they come through from the factory, didn't have a speedometer on it. And he wanted a speedometer on it, so to know how many miles he'd been. And I like paid extra, so it cost him delivered. $365 for a 1917 Ford touring car.
Now, did he drive it much?
Oh, yeah. He drove it a lot, and then later I helped him to get a, after I managed units and like, I helped him to get a, one of the Star cars. It used to be a Star car. They're made by Durand. They don't make them anymore, but there was a dealer down there in Lynn that I got my first car from down there. Was the money that my uncle gave me for sheep money that I had in the bank. I had sold, I used that to buy my first car with. And it was a demonstrating car. And it was a 1922 Star touring car. And the next year they were going to sell it, and I got acquainted with the fellow that run the garage. And I bought that 1922 Star touring car for $225. And so later on, I got a chance, Dad's old car was getting old and like, and I brought him up a Star sedan, closed-in job, four-door sedan. And I don't remember what he did do with the old Ford. But he sold it to somebody, and he had that. That's what he had when he passed away.
So once he got a car, did he still drive a horse much?
Oh, yeah. One time he used a car, and just in the summer when it's good going. If it was bad going, he always took a horse, and then, of course, in the winter, back then you couldn't drive a car anyway, so he used to put the car up over to the other farm he bought and shed and take it over there before the snow come and jack it up and put the put blocks on the all four wheels so the wheels wouldn't rest on the tires, and cover it up with some blanket and coat it up for the winter. And but when he passed away down Rochester, our Earl took care of him. Dad bought a place down Rochester, and then later Earl came there and got his second wife, and he took care of Dad and Mother till he passed away. But he had his car down there, and he used to go out and done a little veterinary work. He didn't plan on it when he came down there, but he done some veterinary work after he got down there to rock there. But he used his little car to go with, and then, but he still had his horses until the last couple of years. When he lost the use of his legs and that, like, he couldn't, so he didn't have the horses anymore. But
how old did he live to be?
90 years, just my age. I'd be 90 years and 6 months, the 8th of next month, and he was 90 years and 6 months. Yeah.
And did your mother live?
She lived about another year afterwards. Yeah.
That must have been hard on
her.
Oh,
it was. Yeah, but you know, this is interesting to me. But while he was there at the rock, I hadn't been there too long. When I don't think I told you about his going up and finding, discovering the horse had his back broke for Clint Reed, Hiram Reed. Well, he hadn't been down that rock there too long. When this Clint Reed and Maida was friends with Gertrude and I, my wife, and we had a married couples club, like we, several people used to get together once and so often in the wintertime and play bridge, and everybody bring somebody to have a nice supper, and then we'd play bridge afterwards. So Reed and Harvey, Reed lived with his father-in-law up on the hill and up towards the quarries in Rochester, and everything was done with horses, work was done with horses then. He had a horse that went out in the morning. She was in the stall laying down, couldn't get up. So he sent over to Randolph for the veterinary. The nearest veterinary was here in Randolph. So he went over from right over to Rochester, and I don't know what he did to it, and told Clint, he said, well, if she isn't up tomorrow morning, he said, you call me. Oh, he said, she isn't up tonight. He said, you call me and I'll come back. Well, she laid there all day and couldn't get up. And so the vet came at night, and I don't know, maybe give her a shot or something. And he told Clint, he said, well, if she isn't up in the morning, he said, you let me know, we'll have to come home. We've got to pull her up because we can't let her lay in that position of circulation, and she usually lose the use of her legs and so on, which is true. And so he says, you call me. Well, somehow Clint took his milk down to the creamery there. It was a creamery. And he was talking to somebody about the horse down there. They brought in the cream, and he says, why don't you go up and get Floyd's father to come up and look at the horse? And I don't know whether I told Clint about him or not. I don't know, but anyway. So he came up, went up to see Dad and told him. And Dad says, well, I'm not a licensed veterinary, he says, and I come down here, he said, I don't want to butt in on veterinaries. Well, Clint says, several people told me down the place that you ought to see her. He says, well, you go up and see her. He says, I'll carry you up and bring you back. And Dad was well up in his 80s then. And so Dad says, well, if you want me to, I will. So he went up and got his little suitcase and Clint took him up there, and this is what Clint told me afterward. He said, I don't know how that man knew, but he said his mare was laying on her side. He looked at her, and he said, he didn't say, my dad never would say anything. He never tell you much of anything, you know, until he knew what he was talking about. And he said he stepped over hind feet, went up there, and he says, felt her ears, felt her pulse, and he said, kind of tipped her head up, looked in her eyes. He said he went back, put his hand on her back. He said, I wondered what he's doing. He said he began to feel all those vertebrae in her back. And he said he was feeling along. He said not a word out of him. Got into one place down in her back quite a way. He said he felt around quite a little bit. He said quite a few minutes and then up above and then like. Stepped back out behind her and reached into the pocket and pulled out a jackknife. Opened up the blade. Yeah, jackknife had a very sharp point on it. He said he stepped back behind her then, bent over, began to kind of prick her in her rear end and her leg as she laid there. kept her pricking up higher, and she laid, he said he was watching her, kept her pricking up, got up higher, and got up above on her side by her flank, and she didn't move, got up a little further, and he pricked her, and she said to her, I had moved. He said, well, he got your own pulled up a knife, he says, you can down to the vet, come back if you want her, but he says, she never will get up, he says, she's broke her back. He says, her vertebrae and are separated. And Clint says, hell in the world could she do that? And then Dad says, well, in a wood stall, not much bedding. They didn't bed them too heavy. And he said, when she urinated, the plank was wet. She tried to get up, and he said her foot slipped and went out just a cat and twisted her back, the cat, and she went down. He said, that was it. He said, you should have more bedding. You shouldn't have such a high drop-off behind either for their feet to drop off from. But Dad said, don't take my word for it. He says, have the vet come. Well, he said, I don't think I need to. Well, Dad said, I'd rather you would, but he didn't. He finally decided to settle, and so Dad says, when you put her down and get her out before you bury her, he said, I wish you'd take a sharp knife and cut the skin on her back and open it up and see for yourself. And Clint Reed told me this himself. He said, well, guys, he said, I did that. It was just as your dad said. The vertebrae were separated. Nothing you could ever do for in the world.
Gosh.
And now that man there was, he wasn't a vet, but he was, as I say, he was a vet. He was a good one.
Oh, yeah.
But when you thought the vet with his horse and his cat and laid all day and when. Was the thought there was something besides just giving him a needle and think you're going to get up or going to